Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan present Point Taken, a podcast connecting you to the sports and pop culture issues you care about and the guests you want to hear more from. Now, here's Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady.
Ah, yes. Episode Sweet 16. Don't tell me I'm wrong. Don't at me.
Is that right?
If I'm...
Did you actually count?
I think I'm very... I've downloaded 15, and I'm sure our listeners have. That's all I know. I just count downloads. We could care less about critical acclaim, although it's nice.
Well,
downloads. Page views, downloads. Greg Brady, Carolyn Cameron, we are both here post-U.S. Open, and we will talk to... the gentleman who's going to lead Canada into the Davis Cup this coming weekend against India in Edmonton's Northlands Coliseum. Mm. Very, very interesting with the conversion of that venue. We never get Davis Cup in Toronto. Does that irk you? Does that bother you? I know you've traveled for it before.
Yeah,
I'd like to see it in our city, but it hasn't happened.
Milo Sranich really wants to see it in Toronto, so we'll see if there is a time when it'll be here and when he'll be healthy to play. But yes, we'll be talking to Vasek Pospisil coming up in just a little bit on the podcast.
What else? Week one NFL. Did you partake in any specific NFL viewing?
I was watching the Monday Nighter, the double dip.
It's almost too much, right?
I know, it's too...
Like, it starts too... The second game starts too late for the East Coast people, but yet you couldn't have, like a game on the West Coast that starts at, like, 2 p.m. It's not a holiday.
But it
started at 4 p.m. on a Monday, which is a weird time for Monday Night Football, 4 p.m. on the West Coast.
Yeah, but did you see what I did there? How it's the double dip?
I know, and here it comes.
Okay.
Why don't you, explain with Latin, of course, being your first language.
Oh, yeah.
I think people don't realize the obstacles. That's not true.
That's not true. That's a lie.
It's not true.
So, okay, if you're watching the Monday Nighter in the second game of the Monday Nighter, you saw Sergio Dip, who was the sideline reporter.
That's right.
And he came on camera, and it wasn't the smoothest.
Now, did you see it live?
I did not see it live, okay. Actually. I just saw it on Twitter.
I have this luck of seeing, it may say something about my career, utter and complete meltdowns, like the Joe Namath, Susie Colbert thing. I'm watching that live, and my wife, maybe even then girlfriend, maybe she's my wife, then says, he's really drunk. And I'm like, I don't think so. He's just cold. In the first 10 seconds, I'm going, he's shivering. It's a cold night. This was around Christmas time because I was at her place for Christmas. And I'm going, it's like when your teeth start chattering. And we've all done probably live radio or live TV and you're in a cold venue.
Oh, it's bad.
That's right. But that's...
It's not like that, though.
Then when you invite yourself to kiss the interviewer, which, it hasn't happened to me. It hasn't happened to you yet.
No.
The closest I thought it might happen was Joe Wilfred Tsonga and Arash Madani. But that's another, he would not mind me saying that, Joe Tsonga or Arash Madani. But it hasn't, they have a good healthy relationship. But it happened very badly last night for Sergio Dip. Now, I want people to hear.
Okay, yeah, that's what it's.
But this is Sergio Dip as he speaks in his first language. And he's a real, strapping guy. He's,
yeah, strong broadcaster.
He can, yeah. That's what he sounds like. I can't do that.
Now,
he's saying, I'm great with Latin. He's saying Mexico scored 5 goals. They got a great jump in the first half.
Yeah, sure.
They didn't fear Costa Rica going in. I'm translating.
But the issue was on
Monday. So that's enough of the Latin Sergio Dip.
But it's good. We're telling the full story.
That's right.
So Monday night, though, it wasn't as smooth. And let me just say, I don't know if you're like this, but when I see something like this, I don't want to go all over social media like a lot of people were and make a ton of fun. Now, in the newsroom, we were discussing it, okay? But
right.
As someone,
I know.
I mean, can you imagine?
It cuts close to home. We've
it
all
does.
Had our terrible moments.
We have. And you just hope something like that doesn't happen to you. But the fact that this is what he sounded like on such a big stage on Monday night. It was tough.
It was a rough
Here
one.
Here it goes.
Here we go.
Brace
with
yourselves.
Sergio Dip now. And let's point out also, the game had some groundbreaking sense to it because it was Beth Mowen's first play-by-play game, and she's excellent.
Yes.
I think Rex Ryan,
a lot of people he was with her, and a lot of people didn't like him.
I know.
Him.
It's his first game, too. Like, I think everybody...
She didn't get the most support for this.
Everybody gets better at what they're doing over time.
Sure.
I mean, is that safe to say?
Like,
you wouldn't ask anybody and say, hey, Ron McLean, about as good as you were in 1988? No, way better. I mean, way better. Me 7 years ago, you 7 years ago, sure. So everybody is going to dip their, it's a bad Rex Ryan joke. Everyone's going to dip their feet in the water.
Okay.
And I think Rex will come along, but it wasn't, I mean, the first few times Jessica Mendoza was on Sunday Night Baseball, I'm like, oh, I don't know about this. And then she got better. She really found her
way. You found your way.
So here's Sergio Dipless. The name is a struggle. If it was like, you know, Sergio Ramos, I'd be like, but it's Dip. Anyway, I'm no one to talk. So this is Sergio Dip when Beth Mowins threw down down to him last night. It's 25 seconds that is now kind of like Boom Goes the Dynamite guy in Indiana, living in infamy.
Beth, Coach, it's a pleasure to be with you guys here on the field from up close, just watching Coach Vance Joseph from here. You watch him now on the screen. This diversity in his background is helping him a lot tonight. Quarterback at Colorado, defensive back in the NFL. And here he is having the time of his life.
Okay. It could have gone better, puts it mildly. I watched it live, Carolyn, and I thought there's something that went wrong. There's a famous video of a woman outside. I think she's outside an award show of some kind, maybe the Emmy Awards. And she had a stroke on the ear, and it was, and she recovered, but she was like, oh my God, like I couldn't speak. And I really didn't know if that was happening. So I rewound again, I rewound a third time, and then I looked up who he was, and I'm like, okay, it may have been a combination of a perfect storm. He's English isn't his first language, but he's an esteemed, credible reporter. ESPN's not stupid, okay? They're not trying to flame the guy out, and they're also not putting him in a situation where he's just going to sink. That tends not to go well. Here, you've never tried this. Go on the radio or anchor on television. It doesn't work that way. But it was bad. And but then they never went to him again, and I wanted
know,
them to.
I didn't like that.
I didn't like it either.
I wanted his moment of redemption, and we never saw it.
That's right. People love underdogs. He'd be an underdog the second time he did it. He'd nail it. He would. And he'd get another opportunity, and he'd be great. And we didn't get it. Like, someone shut it down.
To me, and again, I don't know him. I don't know what was going through his mind. I don't know where the struggle came from. But to me, it looked like nerves. And it looked like being a little panicked in the situation, which I can appreciate. And now my concern for him is, because if I put myself in his shoes, I know on air, if you screw up in live television, you kind of get... You get in your head, right? I find early on in a show, if you have a major stumble or fumble, it's in your head, and you want to redeem yourself, no matter what, how big or small the mistake is. If you're not able to do that, this is all he's going to think of heading into his next game. There's going to be even more eyes on him next game than there are this time, right?
Yeah, that's
right. So the pressure to do well and not screw up again would almost be more overwhelming than the pressure he felt in his very first game.
Right. Like, you and I aren't... you know, we're not live right now.
No.
I sound like
live to tape.
I feel like when Joe Buck was doing his ill-fated Joe Buck show and he asked Jason Sudeikis, he's like, Saturday Night Live. Now that's live, right? And Artie Lang is sitting there going, of course it is. Anyway, but when you are, it's such a different... There's just that different adrenaline.
There's
rush.
There's a rush, yeah.
Right? And we've even seen mistakes of people who don't know they're live and they say something and screw up. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
I hope he's back. We'll see if he is. They generally don't have a doubleheader game, so they use they use their own people on ESPN, and they kind of borrowed him, it felt like, for this game. I don't know if he lives in Denver or lives near Denver, Colorado, where the Broncos were hosting the game. So I don't know. I'm just expecting him to see him on Jimmy Kimmel before Friday. I just am. I'm expecting them to fly him out, and
absolutely,
he'll be on that show.
Absolutely.
Right?
Oh, yeah. His Twitter followers have spiked. Everyone's talking about him. He was trending last night.
Do you follow
this is
him
the
now?
Issue. No, I don't. Okay. I don't follow him. But this is the issue with social media. And then last night we went down the rabbit hole of watching news bloopers, too.
Did you really?
Yeah, which we're not on yet.
See,
again, I feel like this is a karma. This is just one of those things where you do not want to make fun of people in your job for screwing up, because karma will come back to bite.
I guess, but you don't tell me what you think it is, but I don't feel like you have a signature moment. I might have a couple on radio, to be honest, but I don't think you have a signature moment with a live thing or just a real a real messy, like you don't have something that you feel like, oh God, I hate thinking about this five times a year. It just, it comes, you don't like it, and you're dying to get back on the next day so you can sort of rectify it. Right,
you compartmentalize, you know? And then you move on. No, I don't think I have a moment. I'm sure if I do now after listening to this, people will remind
you're
me.
You're due for
a moment. Can't wait for
sorry
my show
that.
Tonight.
Very Great. Sorry about that.
That's what Eric Thomas and I were saying, though, last night in our late shows.
Yeah.
We were thinking, I don't feel, oh boy. Let's just not say anything bad.
Well, we'll keep you as the dip chronicles continue. We'll keep you posted as to what could possibly transpire. Give me a quick thought before we talk to Vasek Pospisil on the winners of the U.S. Open clearly the Sloane Stephens story. Kind of,
I love it.
It took everything, and I felt bad for Madison Keys, and she was a great. That's hard to get blown out at your moment. But she got hammered by Sloane Stephens. I'd seen Sloane Stephens play in person at Rogers Cup. Always liked her. The potential was always there for her to do something like this. But it drifted, really. If someone said to you a year ago, gee, do you think she'll ever break through and win? You would have been people would have understood if someone said, no, I don't think so. Her moment, as young as she is, might have passed.
To start the summer, when she came back, it was 11 months that she'd been gone with the foot injury, and she comes back and goes on an incredible run. I wouldn't have thought at the beginning of the summer, right when she returned, that this would have happened. I think it was the perfect way to end the year and the perfect story to end the year at the Slams for women, when this year was a lot about comebacks, not just her, but you saw Kvitova coming back. Mm-hmm. I mean, Venus playing well with her sister gone. It was just, I loved it. I think it was really good for the game. So, again, it's unfortunate that it was such a one-sided, lopsided final.
Yeah.
But I'm happy for her that she won, and I think it is good for the game.
I think, to be honest, and I've been critical of the depth sometimes of the WTA Tour, I think now I count her, I would count Ostapenko, I would count Muguruza as players, and Keys, so those four that can sort of, I hope, develop something. I hope have rivalries. I hope meet more in semifinals.
That's what we need.
I think it's really important. Like, I looked at Pliskova at the Rogers Cup and I saw her playing. I'm like, okay, I she felt one-dimensional and she got knocked out early here. We know Wozniacki is sort of probably not going to break through and do it. So I think the tour really needs these four or five. And we'd mention Jeannie again. There's, like we've said before, there's not many women that have even made three slam semifinals in a row, and she went semifinal, semifinal, final in her big year, and the road is a long, long, long one back for her to do something like that again.
I'm with you on the fact that I think we need fresh new rivalries, and that's the way to build, hopefully, that consistency and that kind of fire back in the women's game.
Now, I say that, and at the end of 16, if we had a conversation, I told you in 2017... the four Grand Slam winners will be two for Rafael Nadal and two for Roger Federer. You probably aren't buying what I'm selling. And though it's for Federer to go up to 19, for Nadal to go up to 16, what's it say about the year that was? Is it just the year of the injury to the other players? Because those two had their bangs and bruises also. Obviously, Roger Federer wasn't. And how can he be at 36 playing a hard court season? How can he be 100% coming into Flushing Meadows? But you could even tell from that first match that went five sets, I thought it was going to be really, really hard for him to make it through the tournament and win six more matches.
He didn't look right even in Montreal since he started the hard court swing.
In the final against Zverev.
Yeah, like the only time he looked really himself, like 2017 form, was in his opening round match against Peter Polansky in Montreal. And other than that, he just kind of looked... He kind of came in and out of matches, and that carried over into the U.S. Open. What does it say about the tour this year that it was the year of Nadal and Federer? I think you kind of said it's the year of injury, but I think what's good for the ATP is they've been really pushing this ATP Next Gen. That's been their marketing strategy, and Denis Shapovalov is one of those players. So is Sasha Zverev. As the year went on, especially in the hard court swing, that played to their favor, because I think that was a concern, is you have Federer and Nadal playing so well. Where are these next generation players? Why aren't the young players coming up and winning? But we saw more of them and better play from them as the year went on. So I think that's a bright spot for the tour. Now what's going to be interesting is seeing how everybody starts in Australia. Who's healthy, who's rested, and if that'll play to their advantage like it played to Federer's advantage this year.
So as we speak, before we get to Vasek, Shapovalov's moved up to be ranked 51.
Wow.
If I said to you, there's only two players under the age of 21 that are super exciting to people, isn't it Zverev and Shapovalov? Kyrgios is 22 and a half.
Yeah,
and he's
at
a
this
top
moment.
20 player, and I think that breakthrough is going to come. I couldn't tell you if Nick Kyrgios is going to make a Grand Slam final, let alone win it. The old guys are still doing well. That's and 2018 needs to have comebacks for probably Djokovic and Murray, who are both only 30. I mean, I don't know if there's any two players outside of Zverev and Shapovalov that generate that. Look,
there's Andrei Rublev, who made it far at the U.S. Open. He made it to the quarterfinals. He's 19, but he doesn't even have. Now, we are in Canada, so we do focus on Denis Shapovalov. But the way that Shapovalov broke out, you're right. I don't think there are two players that
Jared
people are
Donaldson
talking about
is 20, and he's ranked 58. But I don't think the
again, it's Denis's story. It was just so spectacular and still has been. And we'll see how he does at the Laver Cup, too, later this month.
That's right. John McEnroe picked him as a captain's pick for that. Boy, we're going to – I mean, we got Vasek Pospisil coming. You're the Grand Slam, you must feel bittersweet, the Grand Slam season being over and everything. Like, late January is a long way away.
I know. It's okay. We have something to watch this month.
We do.
So Canada takes on India this weekend in Davis Cup action in Edmonton, and Canada needs a win to stay in the World Group in 2018, and we're joined by one of those team members now, Vasek Pospisil. How are you?
Hey, guys. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on the show.
So you hit yesterday with Denis Shapovalov, the first hit. Have you been trying to kind of keep his ego down after his impressive August? You got to bring him back down to earth.
Yeah, I got to bring him down a little bit. No, honestly, we had our first hit, and he's been playing great, so it's pretty exciting summer for him. And now we have Davis Cup around the corner. It's a little bit of a different position for him, obviously. Maybe a little bit more expectation in the summer, but honestly, I think he's confident, he's playing well, and my back is healing. I've rested up. I haven't been able to practice for a few weeks or do much, so I just had my first hits the last few days, so just kind of testing the waters with that, but feeling okay for the moment.
Tell us how you feel, Vasek, compared to the last time you felt really good. I mean, you just it was timed. It just a really bad timing, wasn't it? Had the Cincinnati tournament, had Montreal been about a month or maybe even 6 weeks before, like say right after Wimbledon or so. Not that you want to do that right after Wimbledon. You're in a lot better shape to get through those tournaments, aren't you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the timing of it was, of course, not very good. I've been dealing with some back issues over the years, and it's pretty solid lately, and then just kind of flared up again. And the U.S. Open was a little bit of a disaster, to be honest. So now just doing the recovery process, but there's not much you can do in terms of injuries or controlling. What time of year you get them, or if you get them, or it's one of those things as an athlete you just have to deal with when they arrive, and then bounce back stronger. So I'm just trying to do that right now, and also not trying to rush the process, but make sure that I come back fully healthy.
Because of how long the season is and because of where Davis Cup falls throughout the year, a lot of players, if they are even a little banged up, tend to take the Davis Cup off and rest up for tournaments on tour. But you consistently come to Davis Cup, even if I think of last September in Halifax, when you're not feeling 100%. Why is it so important that you always are able to play for your country?
Well, for me, I mean, one, I love it. I really enjoy it. I mean, I love representing Canada, playing for something, a little bit of a bigger cause than just myself and my personal agenda, So, I just love... I love the team atmosphere, representing your country. You're not going to get to do that very much as a tennis player. I mean, it's really just Davis Cup and Olympics, and it's very special to me. I mean, I'm proud to be Canadian, so I love it. I love the atmosphere too. I love that part of it, but I also feel a sense of responsibility. I mean, I feel like I've had Tennis Canada support as well, and over the years, and I guess in whatever way I can give back, I feel like this is one of those that is kind of a no-brainer, and obviously that, along with the fact that I love to play. So a combination of things, but honestly it's just a great event all around, and if I have to sacrifice some scheduling or help things along the way, then that's just I'm okay to sacrifice those things.
So considering all your experience playing for Canada and for Davis Cup, what's kind of the dynamic like now on the Canadian team? I mean, you've got Daniel Nestor. He's still playing. He's still around. So he's kind of the journeyman. But, does he kind of play the leader role, or are you trying to just kind of keep him from just joking around on the court all the time? What's the dynamic like?
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, we have Dennis, who's, very young and obviously just kind of fresh, and Daniel, who's, I guess, the opposite in terms of tennis, longevity and age, and he's just it's amazing that he's been playing for so many years, and so it's an interesting dynamic. And you have me and Frank, who are obviously experienced but young enough still, and so it's Daniel is definitely naturally kind of the being the oldest and most experienced, he kind of is the leader of our team. There's no doubt. I'm sure he'll be captain, one day soon, or who knows what that is, but how that's going to go. But I mean, the main thing is that we all get along extremely well, and there's a mutual respect between all the players. So it's not really like anybody is, leading, or anybody is. The mutual respect is what makes our team so strong and bond so well, and why we've been having good results is that we have depth and a lot of character on this team. So that's been pushing us through the last few years.
So I don't think you can carry momentum from Davis Cup moment to Davis Cup moment. But as Carolyn mentioned, you have had success. You were 2-1 against Great Britain, Super Bowl weekend. You were very good against Chile. But I guess it's not momentum that carries over, Vasek, but it's definitely a feel for the venue and a feel for the magnitude of the event. John McEnroe used to captain in the U.S., and he said there are some players that just get it, it clicks, and there's other players that I can't go to, that I won't call to play Davis Cup because it isn't kind of flowing through them. Have you had that feeling that you're more the former player than the latter player, that it clicks with you and it works for you?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely one of those players because I'm an emotional guy. I feed off of energy. I feed off the crowd. Anytime I have, the more support I have around me in the crowd or on the team or whatever, just the better I play, the more I feed off of that positive energy. So I think, that's definitely a big reason to why I've performed so well at Davis Cup. And then when we speak about the momentum side of things, it's just you definitely can't really take momentum just because there's a 6-month separation sometimes between ties. So in this case, it's literally just that you feed off of the energy and if you've had experience playing Davis Cup, the first few times it can be overwhelming because there's a lot of pressure as well, and there's only so much that positive energy can go if you're thrown into a new environment that you've never performed in. But that's not my case, so I feel like I can flip the switch pretty quickly when it comes to playing for Canada. And if, for example, in Ottawa, I arrived there and was very I wouldn't say I was prepared. I was a little bit low on confidence. I wasn't winning many matches. I was injured, leading in a little bit as well, and just kind of didn't get the right practice in and then perform great. So, I mean, not saying that's going to happen every time, but definitely in my case, I feel like it's a whole, different kind of ball game.
I was watching your YouTube channel and your video from last summer at the Olympics and going with the team and going to the, I think it was the opening ceremonies, if I'm not mistaken, or the closing, but is there a certain memory that stands out for you in particular when representing your country where you've kind of been at your proudest?
I would say definitely like the Olympics was an amazing experience. I mean, the first time going there in London was really kind of overwhelming. It was my one of my first years on tour and it was incredible. Back then in 2012 I wasn't really thinking that I had a chance to win a medal, which was different now in Rio. Daniel and I were hoping to get a medal, and But I think still the proudest moment, you know, representing Canada would have been our run in 2013. You know, we made semis of the Davis Cup, and you know, it was just such a great run. I mean, we had that cheering section that was new, and it was just so much emotion. We had everybody on the team pitched in, won really important matches. We had some thrillers with Daniel. I couldn't really pick even just one match. It just felt like that whole year was a very special moment in my career in terms of, you know, well, anything really, but especially representing Canada.
So you certainly have things you want to accomplish in singles. That's the bread and butter. That's what players play for. And you've shown you got the talent to do that. In the back, it'd be the very back of your mind. You may not get asked this an awful lot. When you look at Daniel, as accomplished a doubles player as you are, do you see that longer term? Do you see, I mean, again, maybe not till 45, but you see a spot for you in, you know, a lot later on, right, where it's your emphasis. Yeah. I mean, Daniel kind of didn't start taking, you know, doubles seriously, as he'd say, until he was 24, 25, but he was making round of 16s at Wimbledon and winning matches at the other Grand Slams. Do you see that down the line?
Well, I definitely see it as an option. I mean, I'll put it that way. It's there. I mean, for me, if I'm honest, it's just going to depend on how the next 5 years my singles career, you know, hopefully five healthy years, goes. I'm still extremely ambitious. I feel like I've had a little bit of a letdown the last 18 months, but I've just been waiting for a stable, you know, situation, the team, and really get motivated. And I am very motivated, but things just haven't been clicking, you know, around when I'm talking about my team or, you know, on off court kind of stuff. And I'm basically not fully engaged. So I like to think that I'm going to kind of bounce back strong and have a good run in the singles for the next few years. And I think from there, you know, 4 or 5 years down the road, when it starts to kind of get to the end of that, or depending on how the body holds up, I'll kind of reassess and I'll say, okay, well, should I go into doubles and do this full time? Or at that point, I could also, you know, be thinking maybe, you know, it's going to depend on a lot of things, you know, my personal life situation, you know, girlfriends, wives, who knows, you know. So I think, but it's definitely something that I'm you know, strongly considering. I think I've had some double success, so I think if there's a time that I can kind of fully focus on that, then I think that would be a pretty good choice as well.
With all the injuries, especially to the top players this year, I mean, for it started with Federer in terms of players taking time off at the end of last year, and then we see Djokovic, no Murray, no Nishikori at the U.S. Open. Is the season too long? Is that what the problem is, do you find, right now for players, or is it just still learning how to kind of keep your energy throughout the whole season?
Right. Yeah. Well, the season's definitely too long. I mean, I think it's been too long for a while. Now these injuries that have kind of arrived, you know, all at the same time. It, you know, it's probably a little bit of coincidence as well, just because the season, you know, hasn't gotten longer necessarily. It's always been this long, but it is tough on us. It's tough on the players. We've been getting injured because of it, you know, at different times. To have 4 top 10 guys injured at one time is. You know, definitely a bit of a coincidence as well, but it doesn't change the fact that we need a shorter season. It's so grueling. It's so competitive. I mean, our bodies are just, you know, quite beat up by the end of it, especially. And I think there's just a lot of changes that could be made, that can be made, and you know, even just the 5 sets at Grand Slams, I'm not sure that we need them in the early rounds. I mean, I think it's worth considering, you know, maybe just bringing 5-set matches from quarterfinals on or something. Because when I look back at my career, I really, you know, there's a pretty direct correlation with playing 5-set matches and getting injured. And I've had a lot of, you know, be it Davis Cups, or just getting drained out and then something happening a week later. And I think, you know, 5-set matches are very tough on the body, and I don't know that if it's, you know, necessarily something we need to have early rounds of the slams. You know, maybe keep it for the last ones, but that would be just something that kind of a very easy one to change. Then in terms of scheduling, that's, you know, you got to look at it from all kinds of angles, from the business side of things. But definitely, you know, would be nice to have a little bit more of a break.
you're so right. And I figured Davis Cup too. Like, I know, you know, you watch a ton of other sports. I've always got the concept. Can we make it like what the NCAA basketball tournament is? Can we take four countries? Eight might be ambitious, but can we take four countries in one weekend? So take Canada, India, and let's say Japan and Germany, and put them all at one venue. So the travel's less, the weekends are less. Because mm-hmm. you're right, you come right off that Grand Slam. It's a big reason Andy Murray couldn't play against you guys in Ottawa. It's a big reason, you know, Federer pulls out, Djokovic pulls out. They can't, after playing 7 5-set matches, then it's okay, fly here to the Czech Republic, and you got practice on mm-hmm. Wednesday, and you're out there against a Czech player on Friday. It's too much. It is.
Oh, absolutely. And I've been advocating that for a few years now, suggesting, you know, speaking to even some scientific representative, why can't we have one venue and make it a 10-day event, whatever you want to make it, but just have 8 countries, 12 countries, I don't know. And that way you're going to have the top guys that are going to come, you know, make it best of 3 matches, a round robin type thing, maybe where, you know, it's not too much tennis, but you know, it'll be a huge event. It's going to be people from all around the world are going to fly in, and, you know, like a World Cup type thing for tennis. I don't see why, you know, maybe every 2 years, just make it something a little bit more special, where it's not just a repetitive thing every, you know, four times a year, 4 weeks, you know, just. Like you said, I mean, that's pretty much, that's how I would look at it. I think even from the business side of things, for them, I think they would just make the ITF, and they'd just make so much more money, I think, as well, because suddenly you're going to have all the top guys playing. Right now, the top guys aren't playing because of how tough it is on their bodies, on the schedule.
Milos said in Washington to kind of deal with the schedule and to see how his body has endured thus far in his career, that he's learned that you have to kind of work harder, not smarter. Have there been any changes that you've made to try and just make your career last?
Well, right now I'm going to go through a big change. I mean, this off season, when I get my team sorted out, which is just around the corner, you know, general feeling is that I'm just going to work extremely hard, which basically you know, you need to get fitter. Also, you also have to be smart, because you don't want to kill yourself, but you, there's almost no way around it right now. Everybody is so fit that if you want to compete or get to the top 20, or you know, I feel like, for example, I've been lacking a little bit of fitness the last couple of years as well, where I felt like I was fitter 2013-14. So yeah, I've had back issues, and I think in some way I've been protecting that, and that's the area of, you know, working smarter, is, you know, you don't want to get injured. So there's something about my body that I know that I have to kind of be careful with. But at the same time, it's, you almost have to take that risk. You almost have to just really, you know, just kill yourself in a way to try to get to that top 20, because everybody else is doing it. Everybody else is doing that. And so, that's kind of one thing that's coming around the corner, is I'm just going to really raise the intensity overall.
That sounds great. Now, I got two questions, and they're sort of financial, but they're not personal. Did you see Sloane Stephens' reaction to getting her check? And have you ever, I mean, only one person gets to get presented the check in public, and millions of people watching on TV. Have you ever won a match or lost a match, and you're like, that much or even that little? Like it's tough for you to have a conscious sense of how much a match is worth until they actually pay you, right?
I could go on and on about this topic, but I mean, personally, when I'm on the court, I'm not, you know, thinking about, oh, how much is this match going to be worth, whatever. But obviously, you know, we're playing for the money. It's just our job. We do want to get paid. You know, as an outsider, it's easy to look at, oh my gosh, did you really make that much money for just one match? Okay, whatever. But the point is that, you know, you got to get paid what you're bringing to the table, right? So I think as big of a check as that was, I think it was $3.7 million.
That's right.
I'm not sure, but as big of a check as that was, we have the players aren't protected because we have a full team that we have to pay for, you know, up to sometimes, you know, 5-6 people, depending on how, you know, how much you want to invest in yourself. And those are also a lot of, you know, those are big expenses, and you have no protection as a tennis player. If you get injured, I mean, you know, or if you have a great tournament, great, you get paid well, and you can sustain that, and then suddenly you have a slump and you don't get anything, you know, it's very cutthroat. I mean, you have to really be on top of your game in all aspects, really. For the moment, you know, there's a big imbalance between what these players are bringing to the sport, bringing to the big events, and how much, you know, money is flowing through there, and how little they're getting in return. There's a big issue there, in my opinion.
Well, hopefully this week in Edmonton, everything will be taken care of. Don't let Daniel boss you around too much. Keep Dennis grounded, and all should go according to plan.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Vasek, thanks so much for doing this, and good luck this weekend.
Good luck.
Against India. We'll be watching.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for having me.
No problem. See ya.
So that was superb spending the time with him. I like those big picture ideas. Mm-hmm. Like, not only does he could have a long singles career, then a long doubles career, and he also should be the ATP commissioner. Because I didn't disagree. I would say if I did, I did not disagree with any of his concepts.
No, me neither.
The time, the money. You'll never get Joe or Judy average to look at what Sloane Stephens made and said, well, you should double or triple that. But when you play percentages, we always do this with teams, and we say, oh, that guy gets $18 million. Yes, and the owner's pocketing $170 million mm-hmm. for running the Kansas City Royals or the Oklahoma City Thunder. So we've got to, all they can do is lower ticket prices. And sad to say, unless there's a lack of demand for tickets, we deal with this here in Toronto, right? Leafs and Raptors are expensive because people will pay for those tickets, and they would be less expensive if people stop paying for them. The Jays may go through this in the next couple of years. So it's all supply and demand. But what he says is accurate about, I mean, the ATP and WTA and the USTA do quite well in terms of, you know, you were there. You saw huge crowds.
Oh, my goodness.
No empty seats that Labor Day weekend? Of course not.
It was packed. And I think, too, it speaks to what he said, where I think he said the word ridiculous, that it's so tough to make a living if you're outside of the top 80 in tennis. And that's tough. So that's where, if you look at spending more money and giving more money back to the players, you do so earlier on in tournaments for those players that aren't always reaching the semis mm-hmm. and finals and even the second week. There was actually a really good article earlier this summer in the New York Times, and it featured Canadian Alexandra Wozniak about, I recommend everyone goes and reads it. It was about how hard it is to make a living playing tennis. And people think, because they see Federer, Djokovic, Serena, they think, oh, it's no problem. You make millions of dollars.
That's right.
Yada, yada, yada. Yeah, that's a select few. I mean, that's not happening for everyone. It can be a real grind.
Well, and you give yourself a window. I think everybody does that in all their businesses. I mean, when I used to teach people coming out of broadcasting school, I'd say, luckily it never came to that for me, but give yourself a window. And if you're in 4, 5, 6, 7 years and you're not doing much better than your first year, mm-hmm. you really got to be cautious. You can't let people exploit you. You should make more money and have more responsibility as you go along. But if you don't, I mean, I would feel that way if I was bottom of the barrel selling real estate mm-hmm. and 7 years later, I wasn't improving.
In the same place.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And tennis, I'm sure there's people that give up tennis who are ready to keep going with it, but they're like, if I don't start my next life now, I can't afford to when I'm in my mid-30s, because everybody wants to, again, Vasek said it, you move on. Maybe there's a family. Maybe you want to live in a different place and stop living out of a suitcase. Now, I got something for you before we do What Up With That. I wanted to ask you about Martina Hingis. And
yeah.
I'm going to preface this by saying I was a big Hingis fan when she came on the scene. And,
sure.
And she hasn't always been perfect. But she's 37 now, and she just won her 12th and 13th Grand Slam doubles titles, mm-hmm. which is remarkable. I'd ask you this. Could she step onto the court as a singles player? She won 5 singles titles. But obviously, her last one was 15 years ago. Could she step on the court as a singles player and give it a go? The last time she tried it was 2007, and she made third rounds of tournaments. it'd be asking a lot, but her doubles would indicate she can still play, right? There's, I know it's a totally different subset of skills, but what do you think Martina Hingis would do if she entered some singles tournaments at age 36?
If she could, I think she would, which then makes me think that she can't.
She can't.
Right?
Okay.
Because the effort that would go into it, the extra training, right, the extra time and wear on her body, I think if she thought she could do it, she'd already be doing it. So I think it answers our question. It's an interesting concept, though.
And she kind of went out. She beat Anna Ivanovic in a tournament in 2007 when Ivanovic would have been a top five player in Japan. And later that year, she said, no more singles. I'm retiring. But I don't think anybody on the tennis landscape saw... I mean, it's just odd. We didn't now think of her as long gone, legendary player gone, and then you kept seeing her name on the scroll. I'm like, Hingis and partner defeat this person. Hingis, so to win the ladies' doubles and the mixed doubles, she's just rolling up doubles titles.
I know. Hey, you know what? If she can, why not keep doing it? And it's kind of what you were saying to Vasek, too, about you can extend your career longer on the doubles side and in a sport where you need to make your money while you can and you're not going to be there your entire life like another job, why not just... keep it going.
I love
watching doubles too. I honestly wish it was televised more. I love when I go
understand
to tournaments
why it's
able
not.
To go. I know, but it is fun to watch.
I think it's got a live element that I don't know if it loses translation on TV because I watched a lot of it, and as you know, a longer time ago, more of the better players played. They felt it was like practice for Stefan Edberg or Pat Cash to play. Big time, you know, doubles, and McEnroe was obviously very famous playing with Peter Fleming. Navratilova with Pam Shriver. There were a lot of great players that were really, really committed to it, and very few are now. And I don't know if that's the money being so amazing on the single side of things for the top players that they're like, I could get hurt. I'd rather be in the hotel. I'd rather be doing anything but being out on the court for another 3.5 hours at a Grand Slam tournament. I don't know. Don't know what the reason is.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I'm all for doubles. Let's push it. Let's go. Get it out there.
We are all set to wrap things up, and you know what that means.
Oh, boy.
Inevitably. And
cue the music.
Considerably, yeah. Why don't you start? I have a couple real topical items.
Oh, really?
For everyone out there.
Okay.
That can relate.
So I'll start. What up with that? So right now in Toronto, it's the Toronto International Film Festival. Lots of people are out on the streets looking for celebrities, looking to see, get a glimpse of George Clooney, Angelina Jolie.
Lady Gaga, I saw
a celebrity.
Ryan. Okay.
It was Vanilla Ice, and he was illegally parked. But my question is, and I did not care at all. I did not care to see him. Is there anyone that you would love to see or that you would get legitimately starstruck by?
Okay, there's two things that are going to happen here. One, I'm going to tell you something that I did not rehearse with you or tell you. But the reason I was home Saturday night alone with my children because my wife, Rachel, was in Oshawa at the I Love the 90s tour, which featured Vanilla Ice, Salt and Pepper, CNC Music Factory, Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, and I feel like there was somebody else, and I'm forgetting who that person is, and rave reviews for Salt and Pepper, but Vanilla Ice came out and was greatly disappointing.
Really?
To the lady he illegally parked.
So that was Saturday.
I saw him
Sunday morning.
Okay.
Sunday
so that's
morning,
after
illegally
the
parked
show.
Out of a Starbucks.
So maybe he's headed to Mississauga. Like Oshawa, you know, we get our fair share of shows in the Durham region, okay? It's not Yellowknife.
But you could tell, too, he thought, and this was maybe at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning, you could tell there were not many people around, but you could tell he thought, like, people are seeing me right now. No one paid attention or
if
even noticed.
If you loved him and wanted to shout at him to get his attention, what would you... His name's Rob.
Ice, Rob, baby.
Robbie, Vanilla, Ice. I bet you he gets ice more than any other word. You can only say one word to shout at him to get his attention. Do you yell ice? He's used
ice.
To everything.
I yell ice or vanilla.
Now, did you ever come across his his home renovation show?
No.
You know he does that.
No, I did not know that.
He's very good at repairing
homes.
Who would I get starstruck by? I don't think I told you the story, but I'm at an HBO. Now, you're making me sound like I'm just name dropping on purpose. But Rachel and I got to fly out to Las Vegas. The previous station was within Detroit. We had an HBO agreement, so the boss calls me one day, and he's like, do you want to go out to this fight in Las Vegas? And it was Oscar De La Hoya and Fernando Vargas. And I'm like, of course I'll go. And we got to go to an HBO party, which had cast members of The Sopranos, cast members of nobody from Sex and the City, But they had people from, remember the show 6 Feet Under?
Yeah.
Is that Rainbow? Okay, so people from there.
Fancy.
But also, we're walking into the party as Larry David's walking out. And I would freak out.
Yeah,
with him, with Letterman, with several musicians.
Yeah, Jerry Seinfeld, I'd freak out.
That would be a top 10 celeb moment. And we kept walking, he kept walking, because I thought, he's expecting, he probably looks at me and knows I like his stuff. and he's waiting. And then what do you say? I really enjoy. But people would say that to you if they saw you and liked what, you know, they're like, I watch you on TV. I think you do a good job. And all you can say is thank you. I was looking for a longer moment with Larry David.
You need a line.
And I didn't. It was like I wouldn't have been satisfied with just 20 seconds with such a comedic genius. They're starting Curb Your Enthusiasm next month, I think, on HBO. I'll be there front and center. I'm not in it, but I front.
Maybe
that would be
invited
one.
To the party.
But now I think also I'd say this. Celebs are very – that was a pre-take-a-picture-with-me culture. And now, like you hear now, people will sign autographs, but they'll be like, no pictures, because everybody has a camera
phone. Everyone wants
everybody
a selfie.
Everybody wants a picture. Everybody wants
people
the selfie.
People don't want autographs as much
they
anymore,
do not.
I don't think. I would be happy to bump into George Clooney in Toronto.
Yeah, I bet you would. But that's the thing. If you could post on your Instagram account a picture of you and George Clooney, you wouldn't post his autograph.
But you know what? I would rather talk to him.
That's right.
Than take a picture.
That's
I'd
right.
rather have a moment than take
yeah,
a picture.
20 times out of 20, you would do that.
Yeah. I would tell everyone anyway, so I don't need photographic proof.
Well, I had to. I'm not a downtown person. You are. But I had to pick something up at the Ritz-Carlton. I had a package to pick up. I know that sounds really mysterious. On Friday. And there were a ton of photographers waiting for somebody to come out.
And you said, no pictures,
no
please.
No pictures, please. Listen, the show isn't that overwhelmingly popular. Brady and Price. But I found out later they were waiting for Lady Gaga to emerge.
Oh.
So I go to lunch. This is 11 in the morning. So she stayed in town after her two Toronto shows and did something at TIFF, but I don't know what. And they were waiting. But there were 9 guys. It was legit paparazzi behind a fence. Or behind a fence, basically.
People go nuts.
And they go nuts. Exactly. This is really something. There's a Reddit thread. I said that right.
Yeah.
With several McDonald's employees, and this story is catching some fire, claiming a little trick that they use called a pinching technique. Don't get the wrong idea here.
What is?
A pinching technique that limits the amount of fries that you get in your fries when you order them at McDonald's. So you ever like open up your bag and you're like, I do that with chip bags. I try not to buy chips.
Don't even get me started.
But you look in and you're like,
it's
this bag
empty.
Is 61% empty.
Yeah, it's all air.
So if you pinch the fry carrier, like that little red plastic mm-hmm. thing properly, it can make it look like there's a lot of fries, but there's somehow in the middle part, there's fewer.
Oh, because it's overflowing in the top.
Yes. Like I would assume a McDonald's manager that said to me, do you want to learn the pinching technique later? I'd be like, listen. Buddy, I'm here for the work, okay? I can't. And I wish I could show you. There's a diagram of the pinching technique on this Daily Mail
story.
You need
to stop saying that.
I know, I do. But also, they're too salty. So there's that, too. There's not enough, and there's a lot of salt.
They had curly fries. I don't know how I remember this. It was the 2000 Sydney Olympics, and it was something special, and they had curly fries.
How do you know this?
And I remember getting the Sydney Olympics backpack from McDonald's. Because I think you got it with the
curly fries.
You
eat a lot healthier. Was this a cheat day of some sort?
Oh, no. As a kid, we ate McDonald's. I feel like we ate McDonald's. My parents probably don't want people to know this. But maybe once a week, because it was on Thursday nights when me and my brothers, we all had different stuff going on. And we had to get food in between our different activities.
I wanted to care so much about the message because it stuck with me. But I got through about 40, maybe not even that, maybe 25, 30 minutes of Super Size Me, and then I couldn't watch it anymore.
Oh, I really like
that
it.
Guy,
and yet it makes me hungry.
I knew he didn't die at the end of the movie, but once
it's
they
so
looked
did.
Yeah, once
oh,
they looked at his
awful.
Arteries and his cholesterol.
His coloring did not look good.
Even while mixing in chocolate sundaes and McNuggets and other things,
and
he wasn't hanging in there well.
And any time they said, would you like to supersize that, he had
God.
To say yes.
That was the worst part of the plot.
That's gross.
Yeah. What else you got?
Sorry, I closed my wood up with
that's
that
okay.
email.
I made you hungry.
Yeah, I know. Oh, so you know I'm a big Wonder Woman fan.
That's right. You saw the film.
I was pumping its tires all
summer. A Halloween costume is coming.
Oh, yeah. I never thought of that. So Wonder Woman 2 is going to be coming out. And Patty Jenkins, she is going to direct it. She directed the first one. And she is going to be the highest paid female director of all time, which is great news. But it also got me thinking, I'm excited for the day when that's no longer a headline.
Well, that's reasonable. Yes, of course. That's the,
like.
Do you think
I mean,
it
it's great.
Still be
it's
now?
Something to celebrate. I guess it has to be something now because we need to get the point across. But it's still.
Now,
at some point, she won't be seen as a female director.
Do you think, though? No, of course. Do you think, though, there's. I know that some people fussed about should there be more female superheroes. You just can't make them up out of scratch.
No.
These things have been. So they, but I would say I look around at these superhero movies, and if you're not taking your kids, 90% of the people at these movies are men. And maybe without kids, I should point out. Many of them are drifting alone.
I love superhero movies. Superman is my favorite. I was watching Superman earlier this week, actually.
Which one?
I pretended,
Christopher Reeve or
no,
the
I do
ones?
Like those ones. It was one of the recent ones. Well, maybe 10 years ago, Superman Returns. I have it on DVD. So I popped in the DVD as I was just cleaning my place. But the thing I think with superheroes is, for me growing up, there was never a superhero to, as a girl,
to
kind of look
you.
At, to speak to, yeah.
No, I know.
And
that.
That's where I think Disney's done a very good job, if you even think of the movies, and you think of Brave.
That's right.
You think
Epic.
Of even Frozen. I mean, these are strong female leads.
Yeah, they don't need to sing as much as they do.
Oh,
I mean,
I
there might
the
have been
singing.
One or two
oh,
or,
come
or
on.
Five too
I
many
love
songs
musicals.
In Frozen.
Oh, it's great.
all right, my big push for the week, and it's just a me thing, but I can't be the only one. Earbuds. Sometimes you come into the studio and you've got
ready, everybody.
You got your earbuds in, and, and you look comfortable. They drive. I had my headphones break that are like on the ear headphones, but earbuds have never. I don't know if I have weird shaped ears, gargantuan ears. They never fit me. They always fall out, and then when I get running, like God forbid at the gym. There's sweat involved. They fall out. You're constantly going like this,
really?
Tapping them in. So I need, I can't be in the 0.0001% of the population that never uses them. Because I see TV and movies, and that's all people have is earbuds. They never work for me.
I've never had an issue with earbuds falling out of
very
my ears.
Jealous.
Except
I'm
when I, if I put a,
jealous.
If I'm on a bike and put my helmet on, but I guess you're not really supposed to use headphones while you're cycling.
Because that's a
that's dangerous.
And they get tangled more.
You know what I've been looking.
I just hate them so much.
I've been wanting to get. Why don't you get the ones that kind of they're earbuds, but they have an attached piece that goes over your ear. Do you know what I mean? It's like the sport ones.
Because
I've been wanting to get Bluetooth headphones for working out.
I've had a lot of those
like
recommended to me, but it's like I want to borrow somebody's. Like Jason Rosen from our station showed me his. But then it's really rude, I think, to go work out with his.
Yeah,
it's very
gross.
Personal. It's like,
yeah.
Can I borrow your shorts as well for 45 minutes? Like, they're in your body. They are. And I didn't want to take them, but I want to test them out. There's no good. It's not like a car you can spin around the lot and go a couple blocks. Right?
I don't understand how people work out with the Dre, whatever they're called. What are they?
They're
the
huge.
Doctor?
The Beats
but
they're massive.
But your ears would be sweating all over that.
That's right. Like any, and now that's the choice of like NFL players and NBA players. Like even Jonas Valanciunas, like the headphones are like the size of a boom
box. You got to get the sport ones that wrap right around.
I know.
But yeah, for me, the issue is the cord. I'm clumsy, I get tangled easily, and they get ripped out of my ears because I get caught in a door handle or on a treadmill or something.
I'm going to say that. I'm mostly a treadmill runner. I haven't had a catastrophic injury yet or a treadmill moment. It's going to happen because
what
of
a way
tangled
to go,
earbuds.
Eh?
And someone will videotape it and put it on YouTube, and then you're the next, just the next Sergio Dip.
I know a girl. Oh, there we go.
Yeah. From earlier in the show. I think we should go. My headphones are starting to sweat, and I don't want to leave them for the next person coming in to tape a podcast.
Yeah, these are communal headphones.
But it was great. Great to have Vasek Pospisil on.
Yeah, that was great.
We wish him the best. We'll be watching on Sportsnet from Edmonton, Alberta, tennis capital of Edmonton.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes, good one.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And we'll see if they can continue their good success in the World Group. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes. You can listen, of course, on sportsnet.ca. And we'll be back in mid-September with another episode.
See ya.
You've been listening to Point Taken with Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady on sportsnet.ca/590.